Good. So for the last session, the rules of the game are 30 minutes for each of the proposals. That counts the time for questions. So each of the speakers can determine how much time they want for questions, and then 20 minutes for each of the summaries of the think tanks counting questions. And that should put us, I guess, about 10 or 15 minutes late, which Paul says is okay. So, Howard, you're up.
All right, thank you all. What I'm going to try to do is keep the presentation to about 10 to 15 minutes, and the second 15 to 20 minutes more than just questions, hopefully a discussion, because I think this is a topic that we all of us who operate have thought about and face every day in the operating room. And I'm going to just lay out, obviously there have been many papers and there's a lot of literature on this and there's a lot of discussion back and forth. There have been a number of recent trials that have been designed to look at some of the questions that are raised here. So we're going to sort of just skim the surface to highlight the structure of the discussion, and then we'll really put it out to talk about. So we'll go over the problem, what the options are, some other future issues, and then really try to spend time discussing these things. So the problem, as we all know, a significant number of women who have prolapse or undergoing, who have concomitant stress incontinence, about 40% with prolapse report stress incontinence, and of the 60% who do not report stress incontinence, quite a few of those have incontinence when the prolapse is reduced or occult stress incontinence. Now we have to, again, just be sure we're all talking about the same things, and by the ICS definitions, remember, the symptom is the complaint of incontinence with some sort of increase in intra-abdominal pressure, activity, cough, whatever that is. The sign is actually visualizing stress incontinence, and then there's also now stress incontinence with prolapse reduction or occulting or latent stress incontinence. And these, it's important to keep these in mind because some of the studies that have been done that have looked at this question use different definitions. So what do you do? What happens if somebody has prolapse surgery and does not have a concomitant anti-incontinence procedure? So the first paper there, which is from a while ago, showed that about 22% of those patients developed stress incontinence afterwards. And these were patients who did not have what they called clinical stress incontinence preoperatively. They did not do any sort of prolapse reduction to look at that question, though. And there's another study from India that showed 44% of the patients postoperatively who by symptoms were continent, and by the initial clinical exam were also continent, 44% of them had stress incontinence postoperatively. Now, 70% of those patients, when they reduced their prolapse, actually did have occult stress incontinence, and out of that 70%, two-thirds of them ended up having post-op stress incontinence. So they didn't do anything different, whether they found occult incontinence or not. Nobody had an anti-incontinence procedure. So the possible solutions are you can do, and I'm going to call it an AIS. You can do an anti-incontinence procedure in everybody, you could do it in nobody, or you could be selective. And you could do it if someone has symptoms, if someone has clinical stress incontinence, or if they only have occult stress incontinence. Or is there another method for choosing which patients need a concomitant anti-incontinence procedure? And then you've got to also measure the morbidity. We've just spent a lot of time talking about potential morbidities of some of these problems. And also, of course, behind the picture, there's also cost. So the challenges that we face are clearly sometimes it's difficult to determine or predict if somebody's going to have stress, if they have stress incontinence now, if it's, or rather if they have occult stress incontinence, what's the best method to evaluate somebody with prolapse and to see if they have occult stress incontinence. Many of the studies really don't take an all or none approach. Many, if somebody has clinical stress incontinence, they go ahead and they're not in the study. Only those who don't have clinical stress incontinence may be in some of the studies. And then a lot of the studies involve various different compartments, different repairs, and so it can be hard to sort of mix and match them. But let's take a look at some of them. So this is, if we look at doing a procedure in all of the patients undergoing a prolapse procedure, and we'll sort of pick and choose a little bit, but if you look at the CARE trial, and again, this was the abdominal sacral colpopexy plus or minus Birch in those women who had no symptoms of SUI based on a questionnaire, postoperatively, in the group that had a Birch, only 6% had bothersome stress incontinence, whereas a quarter of those who did not have a Birch had bothersome stress incontinence. So there was clearly a big difference, and this has been This study has been used to really recommend that everybody who's undergoing an abdominal sacrocolpopexy, whether they complain of incontinence or not, should have an anti-incontinence procedure, particularly a Birch. So the things in favor of that approach is you won't miss anybody with stress incontinence. It's a simple algorithm. You don't have to think too hard. However, there may be some patients who have unnecessary surgery, and there are potentially additional risks of surgery when you do something in everybody. What about being selective? So some would say that this is already sort of the guidelines that exist. And if you look at the AUA guidelines that were just presented at the AUA meeting a month ago, in one of the paragraphs there, they mention that few would disagree that operations for stress incontinence, et cetera, including occult SUI after reduction of pelvic organ prolapse. So they already presuppose that everybody with occult stress incontinence may get a sling or some other procedure. Some of the earlier studies that have looked at this was from David Chaikin and Jerry Blavis's group work a while back, where they took a small group of patients and they looked at who had occult stress incontinence, who didn't. They only did slings in those who had occult stress incontinence. And what they found is that they were mostly successful in those patients, and in the ones that they predicted would not leak, none of them leaked postoperatively. Here was another recent study. This is from Victor Nitti's group, and they looked at 140 women who were undergoing surgery for prolapse. And those women who had signs of stress incontinence, meaning they had clinical detectable stress incontinence or occult stress incontinence, had a concomitant sling. Interestingly, those who might have had symptoms of stress incontinence, but they could not demonstrate it, did not have a sling. And what they found is the risk of intervention in those who had a sling because of obstruction was about 8%. The risk of intervention for stress incontinence in those who did not have a sling was just about the same. And then interestingly, the risk of intervention for stress incontinence in those who had a history of stress incontinence, but no signs or symptoms, was much higher, about 30%. And so they recommended considering a sling in patients who have either symptoms or signs of stress incontinence. So the pros for that, well, then ideally, you would theoretically only treat those who have stress incontinence. You avoid the treatment and potential risks in those who do not require treatment. And the cons are, what algorithm do you use? Not all with symptoms have signs of stress incontinence. And what's the best way to reduce prolapse to maximize recognition of stress incontinence? And there's been some work on that, but I don't think anything's 100%. What about doing it in nobody, meaning do prolapse surgery and worry about stress incontinence if you need to afterwards? And this was an interesting study because initially the first portion of this study was done before the TVT was available at this hospital. So initially, of their first group of patients, those who did not have occult, they didn't do a TVT on anybody. And what they showed is those who didn't have occult SUI, none of them leaked. Those that did have occult SUI, two-thirds of them leaked after prolapse surgery. But then when TVT was available, they started doing it on those who had occult SUI, and their post-op SUI rate dropped quite significantly. So this actually might argue to treat those who have occult SUI. Now, another interesting study, which actually is a recent study that is probably a better study because they really looked at it from the get-go with this in mind, and they randomized the patients who had stress incontinence and had prolapse to either a prolapse repair with TVT or a prolapse repair and a TVT 90 days later. And what they found, actually, is that of the patients who had prolapse and stress incontinence and were going to get a delayed sling, fully 40% of them ultimately did not require a sling afterwards. So that in a third of the patients almost, the stress incontinence disappeared just with the prolapse repair, and another 14 of them, the stress incontinence became not bothersome enough to undergo a second procedure. So the pro in favor of doing an anti-incontinence procedure in none of these patients is that some patients, even with clinical SUI, have resolution after POP surgery alone. You don't do any unnecessary surgery. And if need be, you can always salvage these patients later with a staged procedure. The problem with this is that many women still will need a second procedure, and there certainly can be increased distress while waiting for a second repair, particularly for those who had occult SUI, who were not leaking beforehand, who are leaking now. So in the future, there are certainly further trials looking at whether to do this or not. There are various algorithms we can come up with, and perhaps there are other methods. And there's also, I think, perhaps more data that's going to be emerging that will help with this decision process. The OPUS trial, which just closed enrollment, is very similar to the CARE trial, except this is using a vaginal approach, randomizing patients to TVT or not, no TVT. And it's interesting, in the statement of the purpose of this trial, it specifically says the purpose of this, one of the purposes of this trial is specifically to give us guidance on determining who needs an anti-incontinence procedure at the time of prolapse repair. There's another European study, actually two studies, looking at it from a similar fashion. And so some of the possible algorithms, you could either do an anti-incontinence procedure in everybody, you could do it in nobody, or you could be selective. I think probably most of us would say if someone has clinical SUI, we would do it. If they had a Colt SUI, probably most of us would. And some of us would do it if they just had symptoms of SUI. And then there are certainly other factors one has to take into account. Perhaps there are patients who you might be worried about the morbidity or their emptying or some other factor. And this is taken from a recent publication where they actually came up with an algorithm. And as you could see towards the bottom, they actually then included not only the risk for SUI, but the risk for emptying disorders and all that sort of thing. Now, there are multiple challenges that are faced when coming up with an algorithm. There are all kinds of variables. There are all sorts of different operations that we're doing, whether it's the prolapse repair or the anti-incontinence procedure. And then we certainly have to take into account the patient risk factors. And perhaps there are other models that I would suggest and we can discuss. For instance, some sort of nomogram. We're very familiar with that, particularly those of us who are urologists in prostate cancer. And there are different types of models where you can input different risk factors for a patient. And in prostate cancer, we might input what their digital rectal exam is, what their PSA is, their pathologic stage, et cetera, or their Gleason stage. And this may then predict for whatever we're looking for their ultimate pathologic stage. So, and it can predict a particular level of risk for a certain individual. So perhaps there's a nomogram we can come up with, not an algorithm, that might be able to give the percent risk of a patient having SUI after a particular POP procedure, and we could then utilize that information to appropriately counsel the patient. So I think there are a lot of different models. There's what I call the hunch method, where it's just the physician impression and the discussion with the patients. You can have some sort of algorithm or decision tree, a nomogram, a neural network, or some other sort of thing. So these are some of the different solutions, either an algorithm, and I think we have to take into account the risk of morbidity and whether there's another better method. So sort of the discussion points that I'd like to bring to the floor, and I think most of this information is probably pretty familiar with everybody here, and it's just a matter of organizing it. I think the things I'd like to discuss, and certainly there are other points that we can bring up, but do we currently have the information to really make the appropriate decision in every patient? Is an algorithm the best model? And or perhaps should we wait till some of the data from the current studies are completely analyzed and developed before we make such recommendations? At that point, I'd like to open it up.
Questions, comments, otherwise? Do you think that a lot of people do it on the basis of their last disaster?
No, seriously. I mean, you know, it's like based on my last disaster. So if you did a procedure on everyone, you would do it up until the time that you had a disaster, and then you wouldn't do it anymore.
You know, that's an interesting question. I'm curious. How many people here, let's just do a quick hand vote. How many people, if they were doing a significant prolapse repair, and we're not going to argue about defining that, but whatever that means to them, would do an anti, and if, let's just assume, let's put the CARE trial aside and abdominal site colpopexy aside. How many would do a anti-incontinence procedure at the same time as a major, in everybody who did a prolapse repair? How many would do it in nobody? And how many have some sort of algorithm in their mind? So the question is, do we have the same algorithm? How many people would only do it for somebody, how many people do it for a patient who complained of a symptom of stress incontinence, but you didn't demonstrate it? How many would only do it in a patient who you're able to demonstrate it, whether by prolapse reduction or not? So I think we could end the session then and just say, if someone has a symptom or sign of stress incontinence, put the sling in or do whatever you want.
Tony here. I can't see you. Oh, you're there. You chaired the ICI Surgical Committee in women. And I think for the first three ICIs, you gave a guarded recommendation for anterior repair for stress incontinence. as a procedure for stress incontinence, citing the fact that this was particularly safe in older patients, older women, and was remarkably free of any voiding dysfunction. I don't know whether you would like to add something. So was it the Opus trial? Was it called the one that's underway, which was basically anterior repair?
So the Opus trial is prolapse repair with or without a TVT.
So that's going to give some really useful information, because if Tony's recommendation for three successive ICIs was right, then the group without the TVT should actually do extremely well.
Well, and that's just going back. The only problem with that is if you look at this study right here, we can go back, yeah. So the problem is that in this study, still 70% of the patients had stress incontinence with just their prolapse repair, of which, so if you look at it from the other side, I sort of presented it looking at the number of patients where the stress incontinence resolved. The flip side is the majority still went on 90 days later to have a sling. Correct.
We're talking about the trials in the women where they don't have stress incontinence to start with, aren't we?
Okay, well, yeah, there are two. The Opus trial and the CARE trial were like that, correct. Right, so but that's what we're saying is if you look at the algorithm most of us would use is, and the questions that I asked were if someone has symptoms of stress incontinence or occult or clinical. So I think it sounds to me like most people are in agreement. And someone could bring a microphone up to David in the back there, because he's raising his hand very politely. Most of us, sounds like, would be in agreement that if someone had clinical stress incontinence, and by that I mean demonstrable stress incontinence, they would do something. Many of us would do something if they had a symptom of stress incontinence, even if we couldn't demonstrate it. And so then it comes down to those patients who have no symptoms or signs of stress incontinence.
Howard, I agree with a wonderful presentation, by the way. The issue here is in America, it's very common for gynecologists to do a repair, traditionally, to do what you would call a Kelly placation as part of an AP repair, which is a different operation and probably has a little bit higher success rate in the hands of people who know how to do it properly than a regular, quote-unquote, anterior repair. Number two is that I believe you excluded it, but doing an apical suspension changes everything for me, especially if I think I'm going to pull back on the bladder neck. And three, before you end the session, I think it's very interesting to get people's impression of what it is they do and feel is the proper way to reduce a prolapse repair in order to make a decision about whether there's a cold incontinence, because I think that if that's not done properly, you can convince yourself that there's not a cold incontinence, but if you're going to do an apical repair, you've got to get a clamp in, and you've got to get the apex where you want it, and you really ideally want to examine the patient standing and not laying down. And every time you change that maneuver to make it more harder to do, it's more revealing about who leaks.
Right. I mean, and that's one of the challenges with an algorithm is, as you've sort of stated, there's a difference between different procedures and different repairs. There may be.
We do video urodynamics on everyone who's going to have an anterior or apical compartment repair, and we reduce the prolapse with a ring pessary. And we've just completed a 2-year follow-up study following prolapse surgery in which only women who complained of and demonstrated stress incontinence had a tape put in or a colpose suspension, depending on what they were having done. The important thing about this study was that if they didn't have occult stress incontinence prior to their procedure, and we didn't operate on for incontinence on the occults, then they were very unlikely to have incontinence 2 years later. So demonstrating occult stress incontinence, even if you're not going to do anything about it, is a very important counseling tool, because it allows you to tell those patients that there is a possibility that they'll be incontinent, whereas if you don't demonstrate it, it's actually very unlikely.
I think if you talk about this issue, we have to define what's pop surgery. Even reduction of a rectocele can unmask genital stress incontinence. So rectocele repair could cause unmasking stress incontinence. So the data so far do not at all justify any recommendation except the one which we are following. We do not combine at all because due to the high risk of post-operative obstruction, which we cause during concomitant surgery, means prolapse surgery with tape surgery. We rather tell the patient, you have a risk of developing stress incontinence after prolapse surgery up to 30-35%. We have a second step procedure 8 to 10 weeks afterwards, and we tell the patient and do not perform concomitant surgery.
So it sounds like to me that an algorithm, perhaps, though many of us sort of use an algorithm with, I would almost say, weighted percentages, in the sense that because of all the different variables that can come into play, it would almost be nice if we could come up with a number or a percentage or perhaps high, medium, low risk where you could tell the patient that, and then that could enter into your counseling decision and together make a decision.
For the women who don't have the urinary incontinence, if they have occult urinary incontinence, if you are going to give some of those an incontinence procedure, there will be some of them who were never going to get the incontinence. Even in the CARE trial, 60% of the women were never going to get it. And so what you're proposing is to do an operation for 60% of women, say, where there will be adverse effects, there will be retention, there might be tape erosion, for a problem that they're never going to get. Now, you don't know which women they're going to be, but I can't see any point of taking that risk. Wait until they get the incontinence afterwards and then decide what to do about them. Then you will safeguard the 60% who are never going to need the procedure.
That's certainly one of the options, and that's one of the things that one has to take into account. I think it sounds like, from the hands that were raised, that most of the people would probably not follow that. Or at least, you're talking about the ones who have no symptoms or signs.
And even if they have occult incontinence, they actually don't have it at the time you're operating. You don't know that they're all going to get incontinence afterwards.
Okay, so that's true, though it would seem from some of the studies that those patients have anywhere from a 60 to 70% chance of getting it. I agree. I'm just curious then, if someone has demonstrable occult stress incontinence, how many people would do a concomitant anti-incontinence procedure, and how many wouldn't, and how many are too scared to pick up their hand? That's the majority.
But Howard, why would you not? It seems illogical to me. If you've demonstrated that they're likely to have stress incontinence afterwards, and what we're forgetting a little bit here is that if I was having an operation, I'd want to have all of my operation done at once. There's a huge morbidity in operating on people, and particularly the age group of patients that we're considering. And to bring somebody in knowing that you're probably going to have to do another procedure 90 days later, to me sounds nonsense. And actually, if you ask patient preference rather than randomizing people, you might get the patients prefer that also.
So my personal opinion is aligned with yours. I mean, to me, I think that there are some risks of, I usually do a sling, clearly there are, and we've discussed them. My worst patient is the patient who I didn't think was going to leak and then turns out to leak and is very unhappy. But it sounds like some people feel that the risk of developing an untoward complication outweighs the concern of somebody who develops stress incontinence. Is that correct?
The occult or even the overt stress incontinence, as in the Borstad study, are cured or good enough cured by the prolapse surgery alone and will never need that second procedure.
You're right. No, and therein lies the controversy. I mean, if all the occult stress incontinence patients leaked afterwards, I don't think we'd have anything to discuss. And if all of the stress continent patients were stress continent postoperatively, again, we wouldn't have much to discuss.
Before they initially presented to you. If you assess them further down the line when they've got back to their lives as normal, they've been on their ski holiday, they've done the sort of things that are more likely to make them leak,
then I see you may well then see the leakage.
So it's interesting. The paper that I quoted, actually the primary outcome was incontinence at 1 year. And so I showed you the 90-day numbers, but the one-year stress incontinence outcomes were not significantly different.
Was it stress incontinence, or was it a wish for further surgery? Because if it's a wish for further surgery, you know, a lot of people go through surgery not realizing quite how horrible it's going to be.
So
the thought of having another operation is a big deal.
In that paper, it was actually clinical. It was a cough stress, positive cough stress test, or the symptoms of stress incontinence, where was their outcome measure. So again, this is, I guess how much time do we have? A few more minutes? We're done? Okay. So I think this is the crux of the debate, and this is why we don't have an exact algorithm at this point. Hopefully, okay. Is he in charge? You're in charge?
No, he's in charge.
Okay, so we have 4 minutes left. We have another comment.
Isn't it all about the counseling? Because if you counsel the patient from the beginning that they've got a difficult situation, it's not a straight, prolapse is never an easy situation for any woman, and that it's a functional abnormality as well as an anatomical abnormality. So if you get the counseling right, whether you do one operation, two operations, but in my opinion, I would prefer a staged operation.
Can we put the slides back?
With an investigation and assessment in between, regardless of the interval, it could be 90 days, it could be a year, it could be 2 years. Wouldn't that be the way forward, going through the counseling process, using that as a focal point?
I think you're entirely right. And if you look on this particular, and this was not mine, this I lifted from someone else. But you could see in most of the cases here, every case there should be patient counseling. I think here where they actually had signs and symptoms and everything of stress incontinence all the way on the left, they would go, you know, highly recommend a sling. Whereas in the rest, it sounds like they would have a good discussion of pros and cons.
I just wanted to report our own experience. We are running at the moment a patient preference studies in women with anterior vaginal prolapse and overt stress incontinence. And we recruited more than 100 women at the moment. And what is really interesting is that I didn't expect that, but more than 80% of women prefer to have concomitant operation, or basically one operation at the same time.
You know, it's interesting because it may just be a cultural or geographic issue, but where I am, when I even mention the option of coming back in 90 days or something like that, most women say they want to get everything done at the same time, which is sort of how I feel. But obviously not everyone feels that way. One last thing, and then we'll call it a day for me.
A cultural and a financial one. I mean, I discussed the CARE trial with Linda Brubaker, and in America it costs to have that second operation, and it costs time off work. In the UK you have the NHS, and if you need that other operation you get it. So it doesn't have the same cost implications either for the woman or for the health service provider to do the two operations at once.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree on that one, because you're right, it doesn't have the cost to the patient per se, but there's still the cost of the patient is now going to be off work for a little while. There's the cost of any time you have any anesthesia, there are some risks. So I think there are still some costs. Anyhow, thank you guys very much.